Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 152, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, May 9th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So when people become more aware of their habitual styles of thinking, it's just a habit almost that they've developed over time, they can learn to become aware of that, not judge it as good or bad, but just almost with a sense of curiosity, is almost like I said before, as if they're noticing it for the very first time and say, oh, catastrophizing is happening right now. As soon as they notice that, they've stepped outside of it and it's no longer controlling them.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Elisha Goldstein. Elisha Goldstein, PhD, is a clinical psychologist in private practice in Los Angeles, California, and a trained teacher of the increasingly popular mindfulness-based stress reduction. He stands at the progressive end of integrating mindfulness into the therapeutic setting. He's personally been integrating concepts and behaviors of mindfulness into his daily life and has helped his clients apply these concepts in both clinical settings and their daily lives. Dr. Goldstein has published the article Sacred Moments, Implications on Well-Being and Stress in the Journal of Clinical Psychology. His study found that integrating mindful principles into daily life for just 5 minutes a day over 3 weeks resulted in significant reductions in stress and significant increases in life satisfaction, positive relations with others, and environmental mastery, all key players in creating a life worth living. He also has given workshops, radio interviews, and lectures in multiple settings on the therapeutic benefits of mindfulness, including Kaiser Permanente, UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute, and the Mindfulness and Psychotherapy Conference at UCLA in 2007. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Elisha Goldstein, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
And I think that you've been a listener to this show, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's right. There was a time where I was traveling internationally for a while, and so I was trying to collect a lot of psychoeducational material and just kind of really interesting material in the area of psychology to listen to and continue to brush up with. And your podcast was at the top of the list. And so I was really happy to find it and get to listen to it. A lot of interesting people that come on this show that I was able to listen to then and also during a number of commutes.
Well, that's great. And I noticed you put that in the past. So I hope you will be mindful to continue to be a listener. But I know your life has probably gotten a lot busier now that you're a professional.
Yeah, it has. You know, I've been seeing, I see people individually, I run groups, I'm producing a couple different CDs that are particularly, or I have already produced, that are particularly focused on mindfulness for stress, anxiety, and depression, and also co-authored with my wife, a mindfulness for addiction and relapse prevention, as well as creating material, writing and co-authoring workbooks based on mindfulness and stress reduction, and also multimedia guides that are set within a web world called a live world right now. So I have been pretty busy, but I always want to come back. I do want to come back and listen to more Shrink Wrap because there is a lot of really interesting content on your show.
Yeah, great. And while we're giving me a plug here, don't forget that there might be selected episodes that you would want to suggest to your patients, clients as good psychoeducational material, not the least of which will be this interview.
Good point. Good point, David.
So before we get into all of that, and of course our topic is going to be mindfulness and mindfulness-based stress reduction, which you've been doing so much work in recently, I'd like to get into your background just a little bit. I have the impression that you had a rather interesting business career before becoming a psychologist.
Yeah, you know, I was in the world of sales and sales management for a few different companies and was pretty successful in it, rising up in the ranks and becoming a manager of sales teams. And there just came a point where I was really working with people, and what I was doing more with them was finding out what they were doing in their daily lives to see if they were being effective there, because the business world also plays off of the personal world. And so with that and time, I came to understand that I was starting to feel a little empty myself with what I was doing there, and seemed like there could be more for me than that. And I took a retreat for about 30 days went out and really reflected. And at a point in that retreat, I came in touch with, and my background is a Jewish background, I came in touch with Kabbalistic thought, the kind of thought that has to do with really realizing the interconnection of things. And in that connection with other people and discussion and some meditation with that, I came to a point where there was about a week straight where I had this really rare experience of continued present moment awareness. And with that came feelings of calm and peace and a sense of connectedness, a sense of compassion for others and myself, and a real sense of focus. And after that time, I took more time out for myself to start to sit or lie or walk in that sort of stillness. And then I came back to the business world after that, and that was about the time of 1999, 2000, where I was living in San Francisco at the time. I was riding the whole dot-com wave, and there was the crash that we all know and are very familiar with.
Right.
And I had built up a bunch of material wealth for myself, and at that time I lost about 75% of it.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was a big ouch.
Yeah.
And it really caused me to reflect on what was most important in my life. And it really came to that what was most important in my life really wasn't the next dollar that was coming in, but really engaging in life in a more present moment way, really connecting with people. It really had me reflect on that experience I had at that retreat. You know, combined with that, one thing I just want to mention to the listeners and to yourself to know a little bit of my background. My dad's, I've always had a little bit of a spiritual feeling for me in the way I view things. My dad was a rabbi, and my mom's really rooted in her faith as well. And my dad used to go to people on their deathbeds, and they used to talk to him. Mm-hmm. While they were in the midst of almost passing. And they used to say to him, you know, if I just had to do it over again, I would do something different. I would be more present with people. I'd be more connected. And he used to relate that back to me as a kid. And so that started coming up for me a little bit on the importance of that. And even for myself to this day, what I do sometimes is I look back, I just do this thing that I call present nostalgia, which is putting myself many years from now into imagining myself on my own deathbed and looking back and onto where I am today and asking myself from that place, what do I wish I would do differently right now? What will I like to have looked back from that time and saying, yeah, that's what I would have liked to have done? And so it was that period where I realized there was something more for me. There was something other than I was doing. And I really wanted to get back in the field of get into the field of psychology more, to be able to deal with people and help them live the lives they want to live, help them become more present to their thoughts, feelings, and emotions, to become more whole and have those feelings that I experienced.
Well, that's a really fascinating background, and I can see how you're growing up in the family that you did and the things that your father related to you kind of laid the groundwork for the work that you're doing now. And I'm curious about that 30-day retreat. Was that actually a mindfulness meditation retreat?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't of mindfulness, meaning rooted almost where mindfulness comes from. Is it's many thousand year old tradition rooted in Buddhism more, and particularly the kind of mindfulness that's practiced when people talk about mindfulness in this world is more of a Vipassana mindfulness, the ability to be open to whatever is arising in the present moment, non-judgmentally, and. And this was more focused, it was a Jewish retreat, but there were meditation experiences within that retreat that weren't directly rooted in what people would call mindfulness right now. But I would certainly say that the elements of mindfulness were woven throughout that entire retreat.
Okay. Now, you ended up doing your doctoral work at the Transpersonal Psychology Institute in Menlo Park, I believe it is. Or is it Palo Alto?
It's Palo Alto now. It used to be Menlo Park.
Okay, that's why I get confused. How did you end up getting your PhD there?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question because I feel like I've related this story a lot because people often say Institute of Transpersonal, what's that type of thing?
Right.
I really wanted to go back into the world of psychology, but because of this this element in me that felt like there was something greater than myself out there. There were some people really find, I think it's a huge majority of this country that feel like there's something greater than themselves out there or something more than just the material world that's just there, even though that's really important. And I really wanted a field of psychology that honored that and realized that that's an important part in people's development or sense of well-being for many people out there. And I wanted something, not particularly rooted in any tradition. So I'd have the freedom to integrate the field of spirituality into the field of psychology in whatever way I felt that was okay for me. And the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology really allows that to happen. They are very rooted in all the traditional elements of psychology, and they also bring in a spiritual element, which is really often mindfulness in a way, even though people don't want to necessarily connect mindfulness with spirituality because there's a lot of connotations with that. But really the ability to be present to oneself in any particular moment brings us out of all the external things that we find so important, which are so important, but also brings us internally to ourselves.
Well, an interesting little side story here is I was actually asked to consider applying for the opening for president of the Transpersonal Psychology Institute 2 or 3 years ago. I decided not to apply because it was clear to me they were looking for somebody who could walk on water, particularly in relation to fundraising, and I didn't feel I was that person, but I certainly was flattered to be invited as a candidate because I've been aware of their work and known various people there for over the years. So let's talk about your work in mindfulness. You mentioned Vipassana and mindfulness, and maybe before we go any further, we should, and you've already hinted at this, but you might have more to say about it. How do you define mindfulness?
So mindfulness is the best way to really explain it. Well, it's the ability to intentionally cultivate a present moment awareness without our filters or lenses of judgment. Oftentimes, we're very quick over the course of our lifetime to develop these habits of our mind to interpret events either internally within ourselves or externally to any event that's happening as good or bad or right or wrong or fair or unfair. And that has a tremendous effect on how we feel physically, also with our emotions, and how we choose to react or respond to any particular situation. So mindfulness allows us to become more aware of those things so we can choose to respond to any situation in the way that's most effective for us. Marsha Linehan, she is up at the University of Washington, and she's founded or she's created an approach in psychology called dialectical behavior therapy, And that's mostly used for people with actually it's used all over the place now, but it was initially with people who I don't always love to use the term disorder, but let me just use this because that's the language that's in our field, borderline personality disorder, which is really people who suffer from being able to have close relationships and are emotionally unstable at times and really suffer from that. And she defined mindfulness as really learning to be in control of your own mind instead of letting your mind be in control of you.
Actually, I don't know if you're aware of it, but actually I interviewed her on my other podcast series, Wise Counsel, where I also interviewed your wife recently. We should make mention of that as well.
Yeah, please do. That was a great interview. Please go check that out.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, as I hear you talk about, and it's been amazing, there is such an explosion of interest using this term mindfulness. I also interviewed Stephen C. Hayes, who I know you must be familiar with, and yep. He's developed, I guess, would it be a more of a behavioral approach that incorporates mindfulness?
Mm-hmm. And mindfulness is being incorporated more in the behavioral and cognitive behavioral field simply because cognitive and mindfulness is a behavioral approach in a way. It's actually doing something, acting on something, creating a practice in your daily life to be able to intentionally focus on whatever is arising in the moment. And oftentimes practices may include paying attention to sensations in your body or paying attention to your breathing or paying attention to thoughts or sounds or any particular thing and really noticing the impermanence of these things. And the importance of that is that oftentimes in our lives we may get, especially in the field of anxiety or depression or a variety of things like that, we may feel like the feeling that we're feeling in any particular moment or the thought that we're having it is distressing and uncomfortable, and it's never going to go away, and it's always going to be like this. And that's another thoughts that arise. And being able to practice mindfulness allows us to learn that things are actually impermanent. Things tend to come and go. And the more we realize that, which can only come with practice, the less distressed we get when they do arise. And the more we can approach them with a sense of curiosity, or what's called sometimes beginner's mind, so that we can really get to know this feeling or this thought as if for the very first time and watch it as it comes and as it goes. Well, and the distress is less in that moment, yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways, you mentioned beginner's mind, and in a lot of ways, this sounds to me like, you know, what I know for many years as Zen, you know, as Zen meditation. Is there a difference?
Well, I think if people go back and listen to the interview you did with Shinsen Young recently on Wise Counsel 2, which, like I said before, there's so many great interviews on both of these podcasts, there is a difference between Zen and mindfulness. And I would definitely refer people back to that because he'll give a lot better explanation than I would anyway. But the idea anyway with they come from similar traditions and similar backgrounds. They're just one came kind of before the other, and then they've kind of built on each other. But the reason mindfulness is so effective, I think, in the field of psychology right now, or let's even say before psychology, the field of medicine, is because people are really realizing that they can practice this, and they see an almost immediate response from it. People in the field of medicine, the reason mindfulness hit the U.S. so strong, or the Western world, is really through the field of medicine. Currently it's in over 250 hospitals around the country and many more worldwide. But medicine deals less with theory, the way psychology does, and fields more of what works. We don't really care how necessarily all the time, but if it works, great. And so, and the psychological world, in my mind, really respects that. They really respects the medical world in a lot of ways. And it was really Jon Kabat-Zinn who initially came out in the field of chronic pain at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, and said to the doctors there, give me your chronic pain patients who the medicine's not really working for. Let me put them through this 8-week program of mindfulness and let's see what happens. And so he created this 8-week program called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And what that program taught people to do by giving them a series of instruction and practices in their daily lives was taught them how to relate to their pain differently than the way they were relating to it before. So while there's two things besides death and taxes that we can be assured of in this world, which is pain and stress, those are never going to go away. But what we can learn to do is relate to them differently. And in practicing mindfulness, what we learn to do is, instead of when a hammer hits our knee, going, oh my God, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I can't believe I did this again. This pain's never going to go away. It's so throbbing. It's the worst thing, which only tends to enhance the pain, or our perception of the pain is that it's growing and getting worse. And it probably actually is, because we're making our blood go faster and actually irritating the actual pain that's there. But our perception of it is that it's really terrible and that we're suffering intensely. Mindfulness teaches us to notice the pain, bring our attention to it instead of trying to avoid or distract ourselves from it, and pay attention to the actual sensations of it as they rise and they fall. And in doing that, we tend to suffer less from it. And in essence, it actually comes and goes quicker than it would have if we're in the other way that we were relating to it, which is the more habitual way.
Yes. And, you know, I would think another reason maybe why mindfulness has come into such currency is because it, I can't think of the right word. I want to use the word detox, and that's not the right word. But it kind of takes it out of the religious framework and removes that whole aura and turns it into a very secular thing that says, okay, this is basically a secular psychological technique. It doesn't matter what particular set of religious or spiritual beliefs you happen to have. This will help you get rid of pain or deal with stress and so on.
That's a really great point. You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, we can really credit as well. Again, we can really credit Jon Kabat-Zinn with that. He found a way to really convey the essence of mindfulness in a very palatable way to the Western tongue. And that's why when I was saying earlier how I felt like mindfulness for me in a way has some sort of spiritual elements to that, he's very clear in his writings and the things that he does that he kind of separates it from spirituality or anything like that, simply because I think he wants to retain that sense of secularization with the concept, to make sure that it is continued to be accepted in the medical and psychological world, and it doesn't get a backlash, because there is for some people the terms religious or spiritual if you grew up in a home that was really dominating or something like that, that people could have a reaction to that and then be turned off by something that could really help them and really work, which mindfulness clearly does.
Yeah. And I know that you have steeped yourself in some of the other research, particularly research by Dr. Marlatt and Richie Davidson. Maybe you could take us through some of that.
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot of research that's been going on right now in the field of medicine and psychology and mindfulness. And
let me just echo that, because before we had this interview, as we were sort of leading up to it, I had posed a question that led me to go into the online psychological abstract database that I have access to through the university. I was amazed at the number of research studies that are currently being conducted on the topic of mindfulness. It was overwhelming. You know, I'd hoped to kind of narrow it down to focus in on a particular question, and I realized, boy, it would take a lot of time to really review all of this literature.
So there's a tremendous amount, and I think the reason people, obviously, Obviously, in the medical and psychological field, the reason people are doing a lot of research on it is because they're finding out that it works, and they're not just finding out that it works because of other research. They're actually doing it for themselves, and getting involved in a program or seeing a therapist or someone like that who has that background, and they're noticing a change in themselves, and so they get really excited about it and want to do research on it as well. You mentioned Dr. Richie Davidson. I mean, he's at the University of Wisconsin, and he has a long history with meditation, and for him, he did a study that was more focused on brain research and meditation. And what he found was that initially he went into a biotech company and did EEG readings, which basically are readings on the electrical activity of the brain on employees there. And what he found was there was a natural set point for people in the company where there was more activity on the right side of the brain, which is a brain very... basic about the explanation of it, a brain that's more associated with uncomfortable emotions than the left side of the brain, the part that's more associated with more comfortable or positive emotions. And by the end of doing 8 weeks of mindfulness and MBSR class, they found that there's more activity started to shift to the left side than the right side, which meant to him that doing these meditation practices allowed for more comfortable emotions to arise for a person, in essence being better for their health and well-being. You were going to say something?
Actually, I'll direct you to talk a little bit about Dr. Marlett's research as well.
Okay, well, Dr. Marlett, that's newer research. Newer research in the area of mindfulness and addiction, which is really interesting. Alan Marlett is also at the University of Washington with Marsha Linehan. And he has been doing, actually, he's one of the leaders in the field of researching addictive behavior. And he's been doing research in the area of mindfulness and not mindfulness, sorry, meditation and addiction for the past 30 years. But he's really known for his focus on in the area of integrating cognitive behavioral therapy with addiction. And so more recently, in the past couple of years, he's been creating a program called Mindfulness-Based Relapse Prevention. And what that is, it's really an adaptation from Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction, but focusing more on integrating cognitive behavioral therapy principles into mindfulness-based stress reduction, focused specifically for helping people reduce their addictive behavior. And after a two-year NIDA, which is the Drug Administration research study, he reports really promising results. And for helping people reduce their addictive behavior and reduce the suffering they experience from those triggers, urges, and cravings. And both my wife and I, she's an addiction medicine specialist, and I've worked with a number of people with addiction, created a CD that's out right now that focuses on giving people psychoeducation around what mindfulness is, how it works with triggers, cravings, and urges, and then gives a few progressive guided meditation practices to follow that help them work through what's called urge surfing, which is this idea of that an urge is an impulse that comes up mostly in the body or as a thought. And the person becomes able to notice this, watch it in a non-judgmental way, and watch it as it comes and goes, effectively feeling more self-confident and more self-efficacious about being able to work with their urges and cravings with addictive behavior. And Alan Marlett endorsed that CD and plans on using it in a five-year study to follow.
Wow, that's really great. And I've been using one of your CDs, Mindfulness Solutions, and find it to be very well done, very very solid piece of work, something you can really feel good about and that I'm happy to recommend to my listeners. And I'll be putting a link to your website, so you don't need to worry about that. That'll be in the show notes, so people will find it there. And I'll also mention it in my post commentary. You know, this is so... contemporary, what you're saying, Just last night on NBC National News, they had a segment about a hospital where they were experimenting with food addiction, basically, and trying to bring a mindfulness approach to people in relation to food, so that they would be really mindful about what they were choosing to eat and when they were eating and so on. And it was very much in its early stages, so they didn't have any conclusions yet, but they said it was something that they were investigating.
Yeah, you know, it's Jean Christeller that's leading that research. She's also done a lot of work with Alan Marlett as well, because food addiction is also an addictive behavior. Eating disorders are also a form of addictive behavior as well as sometimes obviously related to anxiety. And so she's been leading this research on mindful eating and what effects that has on weight loss as well as eating disorders. I think there is promising results that are coming out from that as well. So I just wanted to mention that because there was that connection. You know, one other piece of research that I would mention that I think is really interesting, besides the research that I conducted as well, which was Sarah Lazar is a instructor out of the Harvard Medical School, and she did research with people who routinely had a mindfulness or meditation practice, and she found that those who did practice meditation, it had a serious impact on their brain. And brain research is always important because people love it because it's something they can see. Now we can see what happens in the brain, so if we can see it, we really believe it. And she found that people who did a regular mindfulness or meditation practice, she found they had a thicker cortex, which is the area involved in reasoning and decision making. And she also found that they had a thicker insula. And what an insula is, it's a part of the brain that's really responsible for, we might call it a central switchboard for the brain. It helps regulate our thoughts and our emotions. And so the insula is supposed to deteriorate after the age of 20 a little bit every year. And she found that it's thicker among those who have a regular meditation practice.
Wow, fascinating. And you just made passing reference to the fact that you had done some research. I believe your doctoral dissertation research was in this area. Maybe you could give us a brief description of that.
Okay, so that was that was a really interesting study for me to do. I did a study with 73 people across the country, and I gave them a very brief practice to do. I gave them a very brief intervention where I had them do a mindful check-in, which was basically kind of tuning into how their body was feeling, any physical sensations in their body. Being able to notice, then turn their attention to noticing their breath coming in and out of their body, so they had a present moment focus, and noticing whether their mind was busy or calm, so they were really becoming grounded in the stillness of the present moment. And then, after a few minutes of that, turning their attention slightly to an object that they considered to be deeply meaningful or precious or what some would call sacred, and then starting to pay attention to that object in a way that was slightly slower than they might normally do, and also noticing anything with that object that was associated with thoughts, feelings, or anything physical sensations. And that object could be something actually physical, or it could have been a thought, or it could have been a cloud in the sky. It could have been anything that they felt was deeply meaningful, precious, or sacred in their lives. And what I found was through assessments that there was a significant reduction over a period of 3 weeks, where they practiced this for at least 5 minutes a day for 5 days a week, in stress reduction, as well as an increase in a variety of areas of well-being. And that was really, although as a mindfulness teacher and therapist who integrates that into my own practice, I suggest doing more than 5 minutes a day. But sometimes in our culture, right now, people will be resistant to doing work for more than really 5 minutes or so. So this provides an introduction, and the results are significant, and it was published in the Journal of Clinical Psychology.
Hey, congratulations. Now, I know that you're using mindfulness in your own clinical work. So maybe you can tell us about how you're using it, what sorts of conditions you're finding that it's good for.
Okay. So I'm finding mindfulness is good for a lot of different conditions, particularly in the area of psychology. I mean, that's why we see so much research in the area of mindfulness and stress reduction, or mindfulness and depression, or mindfulness and addictive behavior, or food addictions, or, regulating emotions. It's really, and not to say it's a panacea of any kind, but what it is it's something that can be used to just create more awareness of whatever is happening. So it can really be applied to any other approach. It doesn't need to stand by itself. And so some things that I find helpful in a practice working with clients is to help them. Oftentimes they come in and their minds are so busy, or their emotions can be really erratic. And so sometimes I help them learn how to become more present. And I often do that through a couple different ways. One is through a breathing practice, helping them notice how to notice their breath coming in and out of their body for a certain period of time, and noticing when their mind is really really taking their attention away in some way, and just being able to wrap it up in a term like thinking or wandering or busy mind, and gently bringing it back to a point of focus. And the point of focus can also be a series of sensations that are arising in the body. With things like depression or anxiety, oftentimes people have certain styles of thinking that have been worked out, I guess, in the area of cognitive behavioral therapy, but also in psychodynamic approaches, like catastrophizing for anxiety. And so catastrophizing is this idea that we're always expecting disaster. Something terrible is going to happen. From some little event that happens, really blow it up and magnify it. And this tends to amplify our anxiety. So when people become more aware of their habitual styles of thinking, it's just a habit almost that they've developed over time, they can learn to become aware of that, not judge it as good or bad, but just almost with a sense of curiosity, as almost like I said before, as if they're noticing it for the very first time and say, oh, catastrophizing is happening right now. As soon as they notice that, they've stepped outside of it, and it's no longer controlling them. They can now choose in that moment what they want to do. Do they want to continue to catastrophize, or maybe they want to switch their attention onto something that they were trying to do in that moment? Or maybe they become more aware of, they turn their attention to their body and they notice their heart racing, or they notice that their respiration is really shallow and rapid. And they can, in essence, learn to, again, control their mind instead of their mind controlling them, so they can make a choice of what they want to do in that moment. And there's a whole variety of different kinds of thinking that goes along with. People exaggerate negative details. They tend to mind read. They think they know what the other people are thinking, and they take it personally, even though what it might be is the person might be thinking this, or they might be thinking something else. But we're not going to be able to do something like that, to be able to treat it as a guess. Oh, they might be thinking I'm wearing that I look terrible today, or they might be not looking at me while they're passing down the hall because they're really busy. They won't be able to do that unless they notice that they're doing this thing, which could be a thought that's going on in their mind, like mind reading, a certain habit of the mind. And there's a lot of these things, and I discussed these things on the CD that I sent to you, which was particularly for stress, anxiety, and depression. And also there's other ones that go along with addictive behavior. So that's one way I deal with it. And there's the other way more generally is just helping people become more aware of how their thoughts, their emotions, their physical sensations, and their behavior really work together to put them in whatever state they end up being in.
Are there any psychological conditions where mindfulness is counterindicated? In other words, it wouldn't be good for a person?
You know, there's debate about that, and I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, there's certain psychotic situations someone who's has a deep sense of, or is really, has a difficulty taking care of themselves because they have some sort of psychotic condition, like schizophrenia. I'm not sure it works really well with someone who has an antisocial personality, which is a personality that is really focused on the self and destructive towards other people. However, mindfulness is being used tremendously right now in the prison systems with a lot of great results. And there might be a lot of people with antisocial behavior in the prison systems as well. So there's debate about it. You know, there are people I've read about who do work, and I actually did a workshop in a place I used to work with people who had a lot of psychotic conditions on mindfulness and integrating mindfulness into their daily lives. However, the way I approached it wasn't in this, let's do a 30-minute meditation or a 45-minute meditation. It was more like, let's do a more informal practice, which is something that is just a moment-by-moment type of practice. And I'll just give a little example of that so that people get an idea on what's the difference between a formal and an informal practice. A formal practice in mindfulness is really a time that is intentionally set aside to sit, stand, or lie down and intentionally pay present moment awareness to any particular thing in that moment for a period of time, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, something like that. An informal practice is a practice that we can really weave into our daily lives. So, for example, when we're in the shower in the morning, are we thinking about what we need to be doing during that work day? So we're not really in the shower, experiencing the shower. We're really already kind of at work, even though we're at home. An informal practice would be noticing when we're future thinking. We're thinking about the future, about what we need to get done that day, or worrying, or whatever is happening in the mind that moment. And gently bringing our attention back to noticing the feel of the water on our skin. Where is it hitting our skin? Is it hot, or is it cold, or warm? The smell of the soap, the sound of the water, or whatever other sounds are there. What am I seeing around me? Really becoming present to all the various sensations that are happening in that moment. And that could be for, you know, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes. But it's more of a spontaneous practice. And you can do that while washing the dishes, walking a dog, listening to music. You know, all that could be woven into our daily life. And so with people with psychotic behaviors, that's the way I approached them, was really doing something more informal with them. I mean, it seemed to have some effect. I didn't do any kind of study with it or anything like that, so who's to say, really? But what I would say is that it's up for debate right now. Okay. I know in mindfulness-based stress reduction in the groups, they say if someone has a psychotic, if someone is psychotic in any way or suffers from that, this is not a group for them.
Okay. Now, you're a busy young professional whose career is expanding, exploding. Do you have a formal mindfulness meditation practice yourself?
Yeah, I do have a formal practice. And I'll tell you, it's difficult to integrate a formal practice into your daily life, especially in a busy life.
Right. So what time of day do you find works best for you?
You know, I do different times a day. I don't have a particular time. Sometimes I'll have a client that it cancels on me, or I'll have an hour there and I'll spend 30 minutes, or sometimes just 15 minutes, or sometimes longer, actually sitting and doing a practice. But what I will say for people who are busy professionals is, especially people who have lots of kids or something like that, I think there was a story recently of a woman who used to have a meditation practice and since then has had a few kids, and looked on the cover of a magazine, and there was some woman on the cover with her legs crossed, with her hands in the, you know, the position that people would think if you're meditating, even mm-hmm. though you don't have to have them that way, with your two fingers touching on the side of your knees. And there she was in peace on her wooden floor in her clean room, and that was the picture. And this woman said, "There's no way. If I was in the middle of my room right now, with my hands like that, it would be more like I'd be laying in the middle of the living room with my eyes closed, catching a nap with clothes all over me and my kids running all around." So for her, a formal practice wasn't really that realistic. And so what she found really helpful to her was to really integrate a lot more informal practices into her daily life. When her kids came down for breakfast, she noticed when she was thinking about the work that she had to do that day, and she gently brought her attention back and looked into her kids' eyes, really listening to what they were saying in that moment, and intentionally asking them questions that she wanted to find out about them that day. And being able to notice her emotions as they rose and fall and different things like that. And so she really integrated a much more informal practice. So if a person is listening to this and they feel like, well, I don't know how I could ever have time to have a 30 to 45 minute practice or whatever on a daily basis, I would say a few different things to that. One is that it's very difficult, I would say, to integrate a mindfulness practice into your daily life without some sort of guidance. I know for me, it would be very difficult to have even gotten into this at all without having been guided by somebody or at least a CD or something to really get me into the idea that I can, of what to do really. The second thing is it's difficult to do something like this without a community. A colleague of mine, Bob Stahl, who's a longtime meditator, he actually used to live in a Buddhist monastery, and he's been doing mindfulness-based stress reduction. He's a teacher of that. He was, I think, Jon Kabat-Zinn's one of his first students, so he's been doing it for a really long time. He and I have co-authored a multimedia guide that brings someone through creating a mindfulness or meditation practice. Probably has about four CDs worth of guided meditation, and there's instructions in there. And then it guides people to connect to a community of other people who are doing the same exact program so they can connect around what's difficult for them or what's helpful for them. And then they can also interact with Bob or I during the time that they're doing that program. So they find themselves busy and they don't have time to actually go to a group of people who are doing this themselves. They can kind of do this on their own time, their own watch, while still being part of a community. A community is really what keeps this going. Without a community, and I think people have found this in the area of addiction, without that community, it's really difficult to make changes. And community is really incredibly important for that. And so that's why we built that guiding community.
Oh, that's a great point. Well, as we wind down, is there any last point you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That's a good question. I think if I was to leave this with anything, with our listeners with anything, it's really that, this is simply an approach that's been really helpful for a lot of people, not just in dealing with, I know today we've talked a lot about how it can be really helpful for people struggling. And one thing that I would mention is it's not just for people struggling. It's for anybody who really wants to become more present to themselves and their lives and wants to enact in this world with more intention so that many years from now, looking back to where you are today from your own deathbed, you might say, you know what? I was really there. I didn't miss out. I was there. I knew what I was doing, or I was intentional about what I was doing. And this is just something that can be an adjunct to life to help someone sit more into the present state of where they are in their lives and become more aware of all the comfortable things that are happening in their lives as well as the uncomfortable things, and help them with sustain a more sense of peace, calm, compassion in their daily lives. And so I just like to leave you with that.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Elisha Goldstein, thanks so much for both being a listener and for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
I hope you found this conversation with Dr. Elisha Goldstein both informative and interesting. You might also want to listen to my interview with his wife, Dr. Stephanie Goldstein, whose focus is on mindfulness in the treatment of addiction. That interview should be available on my other Wise Counsel podcast sometime after May 15 of this 2008. Now, there are two websites you should know about. The first is at www.drsgoldstein.com, and that's spelled drsgoldstein.com. And it contains information about both Elisha and Stephanie and their work, their background, and so on, along with links to their CD and other resources relevant to mindfulness-based work. It's really quite a rich website. At the end of the interview, you heard Elisha mention a program he's developed with, I believe it was Dr. Bob Stahl, aimed at helping folks to create mindfulness communities to support one another in the practice. And you'll find information about that program at www.aliveworld.com. And in particular, look under the Alive Guides menu to a link to one of the CDs he mentioned, and under the Communities menu for a link to his mindfulness support community that he mentioned. On their Dr. Goldstein site, Elisha and Stephanie have a nice collection of inspirational poetry, all of which is relevant to caring for the inner life. I'll close this section by reading one of them by Mary Oliver, who's one of my favorite poets. It's called The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
I'm happy to announce that our transcript effort is coming along very nicely, thanks to some stellar volunteer effort. You'll recall I announced that there's now a transcript menu on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, and we're seeing what can be accomplished with volunteer labor transcribing just the interviews from the various shows. If you go to the site now, you'll see that there are 6 transcripts of interviews up already, and 2 more that are in process. I want to salute and thank volunteers Jason Howard, Susan Argalen, and Joe Kelly for their work in making this happen. And I'd like to add your name to that list. So won't you join these 3 volunteers and let me know a show or two that you'd like to transcribe. You can use the transcripts that are currently on the site as models as to how to format them. Do your transcription in Microsoft Word and then send it to me, and I'll do the conversion into an Adobe Acrobat file and put it on the site. And you'll find that by transcribing an interview, that it's a way to re-enjoy your favorite interview or interviews, really steeping yourself in them again. Don't forget that you can post comments on the shows on the site, and if you do, don't forget to return and take a look, because sometimes other people will comment on your comments. By the way, my friend Jerry doesn't know it yet, but he and I are going to be doing another one of our infamous Shrink Wrap Radio live sessions on Sunday morning, May 25th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. Now, you can participate live with us by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio, and you'll be able to call us on the phone number that you'll see there on the website, or to join in on the web chat. I hope you'll be there. Please remember to help us grow Shrink Wrap Radio by letting all your friends and colleagues know about it. It's a wonderful resource, and we're still in the process of letting the rest of the world know that. Now, the sponsors for this show are Mevio and GoDaddy, and thanks to all of you who've bought domain names and such at GoDaddy, and use the discount codes on our that are on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Those discounted purchases help to support this show. For example, Shrink One will save you 10% on any order at checkout.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Tim Abel from Berkshire in the UK, and just responding to your message at the end of your last show saying that you'd like more voicemails. So I thought I'd let you know how I ended up listening. My partner started an access course in psychology late last year, so being a true computer geek and podcast lover, I went hunting around the internet to find out where I could find some useful content for my partner, and I stumbled across the rather wonderful Shrink Wrap Radio show, and showed her the show, and funnily enough, I've actually ended up listening to just about every episode since. And I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the show, and thanks for all your hard work, and long may it continue. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tim, for leaving that lovely message on Skype. Tim and I had a subsequent chat on Skype, and I got to see his blog, and he gave me some wonderful consulting on some of my search engine optimization issues and so on. He's a great guy. Now let's catch up a bit on some back email. Rome writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, your show keeps getting better. Sorry for the delayed response. I'm in the middle of moving and I have lots of interruption going on, including internet access. You're right, Richie Davidson would be a fascinating guest." Richie Davidson is a brain researcher, and he has not responded to my email, unfortunately. Rome goes on to write, "I took some neuropsych classes recently, and I'm still having difficulty getting a basic grasp of the brain. The more I learn, the more confused I get." I'm with you there. Skipping ahead a little bit, he says, "Lastly, your Sonoma State presentation on the internet was very interesting. I think internet psychology is a very important topic. It was interesting to hear that there are other students that feel as emotional about it as I do. I have a countdown timer that you use for baking next to my computer to get me away from the computer after a couple minutes of use. I would love to hear more about internet addiction, a problem I think I have." You know, Rome, I don't know how long you've been listening, but I did an interview sometime way back when with an author, and we discussed internet issues and internet addiction. And I'm sorry I didn't look that up and that I'm blocking on her name. And I'm sure it's something that will come up more in future podcasts. And then speaking of that class in which I gave the presentation to, I was happy to see a post in the comments area from the class is taught by Professor Shepard Bliss, and there was a post by one of his students, and the student's name is Megan. She might have been one of the TAs, I'm not sure. But she writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, thank you for this interview. At the end, you say if we want to hear more about this topic to let you know. Please do more talks like this. I was in Professor Bliss's class the day you came in and spoke to us. Our discussion started to go along the same lines. I wish our class had heard this podcast first, because I think it makes some really valid points about personal sexual exploration of adults versus that same exploration for children, something our class did not distinguish between. Great podcast." Well, thank you, Megan, and I forgot to make a note of which podcast she was commenting on with that email. I should remember, but I don't quite. And then we hear from Paul, our Rastafarian philosophy professor up in Canada, who wrote to comment on the recent show with Sarah Hannah Radcliffe. And he writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, what a wonderful show you had with Sarah. Like you, I very much see the creativity of her approach and deeply appreciate its sensitivity to one's past." And speaking of Sarah, and I totally agree, and we got so many comments on her appearance. I would say she's been one of the more popular guests that I've had, certainly in recent times. And speaking of Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, I received a note from her recommending another guest, and then she went on to say, also, after I listened to one of your archive shows with Sarah Zeldman of SolutionsForBusyMoms.com, I decided to ring her up to see if she may be interested in my website or book for her population. And it turns out that she lives just up the road from me here in Toronto, and we have a great deal in common. And she goes on to describe some of what they have in common. Skipping over that, she says, we're meeting for lunch soon, and we'll be doing some business together. And on a different note, literally, my husband and I were trying to learn the didgeridoo last year, but didn't get too far. Like you, we found it more challenging than it appeared to be, but it's definitely a magnificent instrument. By the way, on your recommendation, I've taken out a subscription to Psychology Mind and am enjoying it. Thanks for that. Yeah, I wish I could persuade them to be a sponsor for the show and to do a web swap. They would be a perfect sponsor, and we got a little ways down the road with them, and then our talks seemed to collapse. They haven't gotten back to me. She winds up saying, so, Dr. Dave, I'm really grateful for having found you on iTunes. I was desperately searching for some quality psychology material after I finished listening to my podcast version of the Psychotherapy Networkers' outstanding annual conference. Keep up the great work. I'll be listening. Sarah Hanna. And how wonderful, you know, to discover listeners who then turn out to be such great guests. And I'm so happy that you and Sarah Zeldman have connected with one another. That's yet another level of connection, and it reinforces my idea that Shrink Wrap Radio really is a community and can be more and more of a community. Here's one from Norway. Darn, I wish my Frapper map still worked. This person writes, I'm a Norwegian student currently in my last year of what has been a long and fascinating journey toward becoming a psychologist. I've recently discovered the growing world of podcasting and just started listening to your podcast series, Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Congratulations on two very good shows. Thank you. The reason I'm contacting you is that I recently went to a seminar where one of the speakers was talking about a Norwegian website called, and he gives the Norwegian name, and he says in English, this translates to the Health Library. And he goes on to say it's a site containing lots of information on a wide variety of topics concerning mental health. However, it didn't have any links covering other podcasts. As earlier mentioned, and you surely know, podcasting is a growing service, and I know that a lot of my fellow psychology students are taking an interest in it. I therefore contacted the speaker I just mentioned and asked if he was interested in getting some tips and links concerning his podcast site. He was very much interested. I thought it might be a good idea to go directly to the source, so to speak, and ask you if you know of any more podcasting series you would recommend covering topics of mental health and psychology. I know you must be a very busy man, but it doesn't hurt trying. Once again, thank you for taking time to make these series, and now you know it's heard all the way up into the cold Scandinavian shores. Best regards, Bjornar is how I'm going to guess that the name is pronounced. Bjornar, thanks so much for taking time to write, and even though I'm such a busy person, I did send you some recommendations, and just to share those with others, I like the Australian Broadcasting Company. Is that what it stands for? ABC, All in the Mind. They have a staff, and so it's much more heavily produced than my show is, but they put out very good content on psychology. My Jungian friends produce a show called Insight Works, spelled I-N-S-Y-T, works.com. That's Robin and Suzanne Maiden. And they put out a very sensitively done show that I can highly recommend. And also, you might be interested in a show that three psychiatrists do called My Three Shrinks. I have been intending to invite them on as guests. At some point, I'll get around to that. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send emails to shrink at shrinkwrapradio. And to leave comments on the site, and to leave voicemails on Skype, such as the example you heard from Tim. You can contact me there as ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages using MyChingo, where there's an icon on our website. You just click on it and use the microphone on your computer and leave a message there. Or you can call at 206-337-0622 and leave a message there. So thanks again to Dr. Elisha Goldstein for sharing his work on mindfulness and psychotherapy. I'm really looking forward to next week's interview with author Marcia Scarborough, whose book, Medicine Dance, describes her fascinating journey into the world of shamanism. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.